Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Tuesday, March 5th, 2024. I'm your reader, Denise. On the front page, the winter was Cedar Rapids' warmest on record. February temps across eastern Iowa reached record highs, largely thanks to El Nino, by Brittany Miller, the Gazette. This winter was the warmest on record for Cedar Rapids and ranked in the top 10 warmest winters for the Midwest at large. Although our calendars mark the spring equinox as the end of winter, meteorological winter stretches from December to February. Cedar Rapids' 1931-32 winter previously held the title of the warmest with an average temperature of 30.8 degrees. The average temperature this past winter topped that at 31.1 degrees. It was the second warmest winter on record for Burlington and the fourth warmest for Dubuque. Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan likely saw their warmest winters too. February ended the meteorological season with a bang, with an average temperature of 37 degrees. It marked the hottest February on record for Cedar Rapids, overshadowing the previous record set in 1998 at 36.7 degrees. It followed higher than normal temperatures for the city seen in December and January, even with a few cold spurts that punctuated the months. Temperatures across eastern Iowa reached record highs in the 70s between February 26th and 7th. They spiked to 77 degrees in Burlington. For the Midwest as a whole, February was 11.5 to 13 degrees above normal. Precipitation totals were 1 to 1.6 inches below normal, and snowfall totals were 8 to 10.5 inches below normal. It was the fifth driest February in recorded history for Cedar Rapids and the driest on record for Burlington. The abnormally warm winter weather hails from the strong El Nino effect spilling across the U.S. National Weather Service, meteorologists previously told the Gazette. The phenomenon brings warmer than average winter weather to the northern United States, and the Gulf Coast and Southeast are typically wetter than usual. The El Nino is showing signs of weakening, though. Forecast teams predict weather patterns may transition to neutral during the spring. A La Nina event, which historically tends to follow strong El Nino events, may develop this summer. La Nina is El Nino's colder counterpart, caused by strong winds, which results in warmer and drier winters in the southern United States and cooler temperatures in the north. Some researchers project that El Nino and La Nina events may grow stronger and more frequent due to human-induced climate change. Brittany J. Miller is the energy and environment reporter for the Gazette and a core member of the Report for America, a national service program that places journalists in local newsrooms to report on undercovered issues. The total the University of Iowa costs to buy bankrupt Mercy, Iowa City, near $40 million. UIHC also to pay $25 million for immediate facility upgrades by Vanessa Miller, Iowa City. Including $28 million it bid in a bankruptcy auction to buy Mercy, Iowa City, $8.5 million it covered of the hospital's operating losses, and $3.4 million it spent resolving Mercy's unpaid contract obligations, the University of Iowa's total cost to acquire the 150-year-old community hospital is expected to reach nearly $40 million. That doesn't include the leased $25 million more in immediate facility upgrades the UI committed to spend in flipping results of the bankrupt auction from the bondholder Preston Hollow and trustee CompuShare, first declared the winner in October with $29 million bid to the university. The Mercy operating losses UIHC calculated as part of its final purchase price don't reflect a monthly operating cost the hospital filed with the bankruptcy court, showing $30.6 million in operating costs for January alone. The operating losses that UIHC agreed to cover differ from those required for court records. This is a complicated and expensive process, UIHC Vice President for Medical Affairs Denise Jamison told the Gazette in January. We anticipate that, as a site, Mercy is not going to make money anytime in the near future. We understand that. We've built that into our projections. But what we anticipate, what we hope for, is that we're creating a sustainable system for them so that the employees know that when they sign on with us, they're within a safety net of a university system. Transition to date. Fast forward to last week, nearly a month after UIHC officially absorbed into its sprawling healthcare network, the former Mercy Iowa City campus, nearly 1,000 new employees and physicians, 192 licensed beds, and 10 clinic locations, Jamison told the Board of Regents, the go live week went very well, with minimal issues and no disruption to patient care. In addition to Mercy Iowa City, which UIHC renamed its Medical Center downtown campus, the university next year is planning to debut a $525.6 million orthopedics-heavy hospital in North Liberty, which also will include an emergency room. For now, our approach is that we're maintaining existing medical services at our downtown campus, Jamison told the Regents. We're going to be focusing on really stabilizing operations, beginning critical infrastructure repairs, implementing EPIC, our electronic medical record, and we'll be conducting a comprehensive review on the best way to operate coordinated care across what we now will be three campuses when North Liberty comes online. Through that process, Jamison said, UIHC will seek input from community stakeholders. As we look toward the future, we also need to consider larger questions for how we're going to organize our health care overall in our mission to ensure access to health care for Iowans, she said. UIHC Chief Financial Officer Brady Hawes provided Regents with more detail on what community and workplace feedback would be like, including creation of a new advisory committee involving six community members. Those community members include Iowa City-based lawyer Tom Gilman, a UI alumni and Iowa City native, Robin Thurm, president of CIVCO Medical Solutions and former UI adjunct faculty member and alumnus, Pete Wallace, a UI alumnus who worked at Mercy, Iowa City, and was medical director and chair of the Johnson County Board of Health, Ann Perino, a UI alumnus and anesthesiologist at Mercy, Iowa City, Latasha Deloach, coordinator of the Iowa City Senior Center, and Jeff Quinlan, professor, chair, and department executive officer of the UI Department of Family Medicine. The university also added three downtown campus team members to an existing clinical staff committee and created a new committee aimed at addressing the needs of 300 community health care providers who will continue to be allowed to care for the patients at the downtown campus without being employed by the UI, so that they can also have a voice with the senior management team at UI Healthcare, and that we're understanding what their needs and perspectives are as we continue to integrate, Hawes said. Downtown campus future. Looking forward, the university has kicked off a coordinated process to field ideas and requests and suggestions around what services should be provided on that campus. UIHC administrators are collecting feedback from existing UI team members, those from the former Mercy campus, and the community. As part of that strategic assessment, we've commissioned a facility and equipment assessment to look at the condition of what they have there on the downtown campus and how that integrates into our existing structures, Hawes said. That assessment will incorporate infrastructure, equipment, and issues from leaky roofs to backup generator power to the size and scope of the rooms, and many, many details that will also integrate back to the services that we want to put here. Which ones do we want to invest in, Hawes said? Which ones will we actually co-locate on the academic main campus, and which ones will we move there? The heaviest lift underway is transitioning the new downtown campus into UIHC's electronic medical system, EPIC, according to Hawes. The planned go-live date for that transition is May 4th. It's such a big lift that some of the downtown team has basically said, we're really looking forward to integrating with you, but in the short term, we have to be all hands on deck for EPIC, Hawes said. Regarding operations since UIHC took over Mercy, Hawes said patient volumes have remained consistent or even seen increases in areas. We feel good about the fact that we did not see a reduction in services being provided, he said, and we hope to grow these services over time. Identifying ways the campus integration has been helpful, Hawes said some aged CT machines on the downtown campus went down at one point, diverting those services to the UIHC main campus instead. But in the opposite direction, on one day in February, UIHC was at capacity in its labor and delivery department. We were full in terms of capacity to deliver new babies, and we were able to redirect, prior to mothers showing up here, the services over to that campus so that mothers were scheduled for an induction or a C-section were able to keep that date, Hawes said. They didn't have to reschedule time away or family in town, and we were able to use our integration OB teams to deliver those services now in combined service. So the ability to move patients more in a coordinated fashion, I think, is a real win for the community as we go forward, he said. Wells Fargo ends banking operations in downtown Cedar Rapids. Investment office remains open as company weighs building's future, by Marissa Payne, the Gazette, Cedar Rapids. Wells Fargo this week will close banking operations at its downtown Cedar Rapids branch while the fate of the building waits to be decided. The branch at 150 First Avenue Northeast posted a notice late last week that it would close banking operations there at 11 a.m. Wednesday, but the Wells Fargo Advisor's Office on the building's second floor will remain open to assist with customers' investing needs. The bank's two other offices in Cedar Rapids at 3570 First Avenue Northeast and 500 33rd Avenue Southwest will remain open for business for normal banking needs. All branch employees at the downtown location will be transferred to other Wells Fargo branches, spokesman Mike Slusark said in a statement on Monday. Because we currently have bank branches so close to each other, we are consolidating them into fewer locations, Slusark said. Wells Fargo owns the 151st Avenue Northeast property, and offices are considering future options, Slusark said, but no decisions have been made yet. Although the branch will not fully shutter, the decision adds to the remote work trends brought on by COVID-19 pandemic that have resulted in fewer workers going downtown and growing number of office vacancies in Cedar Rapids City Center. According to a Cedar Rapids commercial real estate report recently unveiled by GLD Commercial, the approximately 3.4 million square feet of office space in the city's central district business ended 2023 with a vacancy rate of 15.53%, up from 14.03% at the beginning of the year. U.S. Bank's branch banking services downtown were among the vacancies. Banks across the United States have closed their costly brick-and-mortar locations in recent years. According to Daily Mail, Wells Fargo closed more locations than any other bank in 2023, shuttering 312 branches nationwide. Wells Fargo has reduced its Iowa footprint and laid off workers since a fake account scandal in 2016, the Des Moines Register reported, when regulators accused employees of opening accounts without customers' knowledge to meet corporate sales goals. As a result, regulators have imposed an asset cap that limits Wells Fargo's growth until issues related to this scandal are resolved, Yahoo Finance reported. A slowdown in Wells Fargo's mortgage business, which has its headquarters in Des Moines, has added to the challenges. In 2023, Wells Fargo announced it would step back from the housing market as the Federal Reserve's interest rate hike contributed to a collapse of the lending market, driving down demand for mortgages and refinancing the cost of buying homes grew. Last month, Wells Fargo announced more layoffs from its Jordan Creek Parkway campus in West Des Moines, bringing the total reduction of Wells Fargo's workforce to 1,356 since 2018, according to the Register. In late 2023, Yahoo Finance reported Wells Fargo Chief Executive Officer Charlie Scharf announced plans to cut the company's workforce. Wells Fargo eliminated 11,300 jobs, or 4.7% of its workforce, in 2023. On the Iowa Today page, Valero joins Summit's proposed CO2 pipeline. Company has 5 Iowa ethanol plants that would be connected to Route, by Aaron Jordan, the Gazette. Valero, the world's second largest ethanol producer with 5 plants in Iowa, has agreed to connect to Summit Carbon Solutions' proposed carbon dioxide pipeline. 8 of Valero's facilities, including plants in Charles City, Lakota, Fort Dodge, Albert City, and Hartley, as well as one plant each in Nebraska, Minnesota, and South Dakota, are expected to join Summit's project, already estimated at 2,400 miles long, if the pipeline is approved by regulators. Participation from these 8 facilities adds 1.1 billion gallons of ethanol per year and will lead to the capture of 3.1 million metric tons of CO2 annually, Summit said in a statement Monday. Summit plans to gather CO2 from ethanol plants and ship it via pipeline to North Dakota, where the company plans to inject it deep into the ground. The project's estimated cost is over $5 billion, but Summit and its partners could collect up to $18 billion in federal tax credits over 12 years, Inside Climate News reported Monday. With the inclusion of Valero, a San Antonio-based company, Summit's project now includes 57 ethanol plants across the upper Midwest, from which Summit plans to capture and sequester more than 16 million metric tons of CO2 per year, the firm said. The Iowa Utilities Board is considering Summit's application for a permit to build 680 miles of its pipeline in Iowa. Summit is asking the board to grant permission to use eminent domain to force landowners to sell easements to it to build and maintain the pipeline. Summit said in August it had voluntary leases on about 75% of the route, but many landowners don't think they should be forced to have a private hazardous liquid pipeline on their property. Of the 5 Valero sites in Iowa, only one, in Albert City, is in a county where Summit doesn't already plan to run a leg of its proposed pipeline. A news release about Valero does not say how Summit would connect to the facilities or whether it would need to seek an additional permit. Summit also doesn't say whether adding more CO2 suppliers would increase the diameter of the proposed pipeline. The company did not reply to an email seeking clarification on these points. POET, the world's largest ethanol producer, announced in January it would link its ethanol plants in Iowa and South Dakota to Summit's pipeline after another pipeline proposal by Navigator Heartland Greenway folded. The POET plants in Iowa are not on Summit's original route and will require another permit application in Iowa. This project ensures the agricultural and biofuel industries will remain dynamic and competitive, meeting the needs of today while preparing for the opportunities of tomorrow, Bruce Rastetter, founder and executive chair of Summit Agricultural Group, said in a statement. Independence woman dies in Benton County crash, by Emily Anderson. One person died and one person was seriously injured Friday in a head-on collision in Benton County, according to the Iowa State Patrol. Megan Devane, 21, of Independence, was driving north in a 2013 Jeep Patriot on Highway 150, just north of Urbana, about 4 p.m. Friday. She drove into the southbound lane for an unknown reason and crashed into a 2022 GMC Sierra pickup being driven by Jeffrey Burroughs, 50, of North Liberty, according to a crash report. Devane was pronounced dead at the scene, and Burroughs was flown to the University of Iowa hospitals and clinics with serious injuries. The crash remains under investigation by the Iowa State Patrol, the report states. Iowa City man charged with sexually abusing a 9-year-old, by Emily Anderson. An Iowa City man was arrested over the weekend on a sexual abuse charge after police say he sexually abused a 9-year-old child. Gabriel Elambe Etuma, 21, is charged with second-degree sexual abuse. The abuse happened Saturday night around 9:30 p.m. in an Iowa City residence, according to the criminal complaint. It was caught by family members who walked in during the abuse and forcibly removed Elambe Etuma, the complaint states. The complaint doesn't clarify whether the witnesses were family members of Elambe Etuma or the victim. A no-contact order has been filed on behalf of the victim. Elambe Etuma is being held in the Johnson County Jail on a $50,000 cash-only bond. Reynolds announces $1 million for school child care center grants. Governor Kim Reynolds on Thursday announced $1 million in grant funding through the Iowa Department of Education for school districts that partner with or create local child care centers to help more high school students earn a National Child Development Credit. Districts awarded funding will receive course curriculum that meets both professional development requirements outlined by Iowa Health and Human Services for employees of Iowa licensed child care centers and the classroom requirements for a child development associate, a CDA credential. Eligible school districts that partner with a licensed child care center, including school operated child care programs, can apply for up to $15,000 for each of the 2024-25 and 2025-26 school years for a total of $30,000. Allowable costs include student exam fees, textbooks, CDA course materials, student stipends, licensed child care partner stipends, and other approved expenses that help remove barriers to participation. Grant applications are being accepted at iowagrants.gov. The deadline to apply is noon, March 29th. For more information about the Credentials for Child Care Careers grants, it's available at the Iowa Department of Education's website. Iowa contracts for special education services. Also, House votes to increase penalties for fentanyl-related deaths. Des Moines. The state will contract with Suburban Des Moines Company to provide guidance to Iowa families with special education students, the Iowa Department of Education announced Monday. The Iowa Department of Education said it will allocate $1 million for the first year of the program to ASK, Ask Resource Center in Johnston. The contract period started March 1st, according to a news release from the Education Department. The funding will come from the State Department Education's federal funding via the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, which is dedicated to special education services for ages 3 to 21, according to the news release. Previously, the state contracted with Iowa's area education agencies on a similar program. The state in Iowa informed AEA leaders that it no longer will contract with the agencies on what was called the Family Educator Partners Program, under which AEA coordinators at no cost to families provided support, information, and resources to families and educators about special ed services that are available to Iowa students with disabilities and their families. The state allocated $1.3 million for that program during the most recent state budget year from that same federal funding source, according to Iowa Department of Education spokeswoman. A spokesman for Governor Kim Reynolds said last week that the state is separating from the AEAs on the Family Education Partners Program because of conflicts of interest. The program workers are also AEA employees, and because of what he said were inconsistencies in support provided and confusion over roles and responsibilities as identified in a 2014 report. The new program through Ask Resource Center will provide access to family support specialists and other professionals who will help families understand their rights in accessing what their child needs to be successful in and outside of the classroom, the news release says. Under the new program, according to the State Education Department, Ask Resource Center will have 18 full-time equivalent staff, including a family support supervisor, lead family support specialist, 9 full-time family support specialists, and additional part-time professionals who will provide one-on-one support to families of students with disabilities. Services provided will, according to the state, include helping families understand program requirements and case law, preparing families for meetings with their child's individualized education program team, attending IEP meetings with families to help them articulate concerns and make requests, and supporting families in navigating through disputes with schools. The Department of Education remains committed to ensuring all families of children with disabilities consistently receive timely, high-quality resources and supports that are responsive to their needs, the Iowa Department of Education Director Mackenzie Snow said in a statement. In a partnership with Ask Resource Center, families across Iowa will have the support of family specialists, family mentors, and experts focused on accessibility and post-secondary transitions as they advocate for their children with disabilities. Reynolds names board appointees. Governor Kim Reynolds has made dozens of appointments to state boards and commissions. In addition to many reappointments, Reynolds named new members to some boards. Douglas Hoisington to the Board of Medicine, James Moses to the Board of Parole, and Luke Martz to the Public Information Board. All appointments are subject to confirmation by the Iowa Senate. Iowa House GOP ratchets up fentanyl death penalty. Iowa House Republicans passed a bill that would make a person eligible for a first-degree murder charge for selling or providing another person with fentanyl that results in their death. A person who is convicted of first-degree murder under the bill would receive life in prison without the possibility of parole. The bill, House File 2576, passed the Senate 86-12. It is now eligible for consideration in the Senate. Republicans said the bill was necessary to help address historically high overdose deaths from fentanyl and the trafficking of the drug in Iowa. Some Democrats, though, warned the bill would implicate teenagers and people who share a drug or a pill with a friend not knowing it has fentanyl in it. Under the bill, any delivery of the drug, including sharing in social settings, would make someone eligible for life in prison. Fentanyl is a potent systemic opioid that is often pressed to look like prescription opioids or mixed with other drugs being sold illicitly. This is an extreme punishment because we have an extreme problem in Iowa, said Republican Representative Ann Meyer of Fort Dodge. And I'm here to fight for those parents of those family members of people that are getting swept up for some reason taking a counterfeit pill. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Tuesday, March 5th, 2024, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Alta Fern Stutzman Widmer, Iowa City, passed away peacefully on Thursday, February 29th, 2024, at Highland Ridge Care Center in Williamsburg, Iowa, after a period of declining health. A time of celebration of life and visitation will be held on Saturday, April 6, 2024, from 2 to 4 p.m. at Gay and Chiha Funeral and Cremation Service in Iowa City. A private family burial will be held at Memory Gardens Cemetery prior to the visitation. Michael Donald Brohammer, Cedar Rapids, age 67, formerly of Cresco, Iowa, died on Tuesday, February 27, 2024, at Mercy Medical Center in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. A prayer service for Mike will be held at 1 p.m. on Saturday, March 9, 2024, at the Hint Hubeck Funeral Home in Cresco, Iowa, with Leroy Webb officiating. A visitation will be held for 1 hour prior to the start of the service from 12 to 1 p.m. at the funeral home. Burial will take place at Calvary Cemetery in Cresco, Iowa. In lieu of flowers and as an expression of sympathy, donations may be mailed directly to the Hint Hudeck Funeral Home at 404 North Elm Street, Cresco, Iowa, 52136, in memory of Mike Brohammer. Wilbur Charles Miller, 90, of Cedar Rapids, formerly Olin and Marion, passed away at home with family on March 3, 2024. A visitation will be held on Thursday, March 7th from 10 a.m. until 12 noon at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. A graveside service with military honors will follow the visitation at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Ronald D. Denny, 83, of Fort Myers, Florida, formerly of Cedar Rapids, passed away peacefully on Sunday, February 25, 2024, at the Hope Hospice House in Lehigh Acres, Florida. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, March 12, 2024, at Broche Funeral Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids, located at 2121 Bowling Street Southwest. Memorial Mass will be 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, March 13, 2024, at St. Elizabeth Ann Seton Catholic Church in Hiawatha. Private family interment will be at a later date. Greg Hansel Harrison, age 73, passed away February 29, 2024, in Anamosa, Iowa, of heart failure. A family memorial service will be held at a later date, officiated by Reverend Joseph Blay. memorial in Greg's memory may be made to First United Methodist Church, Marengo, Iowa, where he was a member for many years. Kloster Funeral Home, Marengo, Iowa, is assisting the family with arrangements. Wendy Mae Sundberg, 67, of Vinton, Iowa, passed away on Thursday, February 29, 2024, at her home. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Marion is assisting the family. Kenton L. Hatcher II, 49, of Coggan, passed away unexpectedly March 1, 2024. In accordance with Kenton's wishes, a private family gathering was held. The family appreciates the outpouring of love and support during this difficult time. Robert Leo Weatherby, 65, of Cedar Rapids, was born on October 30, 1958, in Tallahassee, Florida, and died on February 28, 2024. Private services will be held at a later date. Fern Weir of Iowa City peacefully passed away at her son's home on March 1, 2024, at the age of 99. A celebration of life will be held at a later date. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be made to Unity Point Hospice, Cedar Rapids. Darlene G. Bentley, 66, of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, passed away Sunday, March 3, 2024, at her home. Visitation 12 to 2 p.m. Friday, March 8, 2024, at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Cedar Rapids. Funeral service will follow immediately at 2 p.m. at the funeral home. Burial, Linwood Cemetery, Cedar Rapids. Valdine Charles Lemke, Iowa City, passed away peacefully at his home on February 27, 2024. A visitation for family and friends was held on Friday, March 1st from 5:30 to 7 p.m. at Gay and Chiha Funeral and Cremation Service, with a funeral service held at 10:30 a.m. on Saturday, March 2nd at Gloria Day Lutheran Church in Iowa City. And now for some sports. Girls All-State Basketball. Solon's Levin is Miss Iowa Basketball. She heads a list of 13 area first-team All-State selections by Jeff Linder. Girls State Basketball Week wasn't without its perils for Callie Levin of the Solon Spartans. We were up until 2:30 Saturday morning in the hotel. We were up cheering. We ordered pizzas, Levin said, and we got stuck in the elevator. That's a pretty minor setback in what was otherwise a glorious week. A 5'9" guard and a University of Iowa recruit, Levin engineered Solon's run to the Class 3A championship, its first title in 26 years. About 12 hours later, also at Wells Fargo Arena, she was selected as Miss Iowa Basketball 2024 during all-state voting conducted by the Iowa Print Sports Writers Association. Only seniors are eligible for the award. "I'm a little surprised because there are a lot of good players out there," Levin said. "I'm really grateful. It's been an amazing ride." Levin averaged 22 points, 6.9 rebounds, 4.5 assists, and 4.8 steals per game in her senior season as the Spartans went 24-3. She closes her career with 1,984 points, 535 rebounds, 412 assists, and 417 steals. She was the key figure in Solon's revival in girls basketball. The Spartans were 79-20 since her freshman year. "It's been a lot of fun," Solon coach Jamie Smith said. "She's a great kid, a competitor. Sometimes when you're a competitor, people have an eye out for you. She's got better every year, and one reason we grew as a team was because we got more scorers around her." Levin will be part of a much accomplished freshman class of five next season at Iowa, and I'm hoping I continue to grow as a player, she said. "I'm going to work on my mid-range jumper, getting more consistent and stronger. In the Big Ten, you can't go off on one foot. You've got to go up strong." Three area teams, Clear Creek Amana, Class 4A, Solon, Class 3A, and North Lynn, Class 1A, earned state championships last week. Each of those teams has a pair of first-team All-State selections. Led by Ava Locklear and Avery Lauer, Clear Creek Amana completed a 26-0 season, capped by a 43-25 victory over Waverly Shell Rock in the 4A title game. North Lynn, 26-1, won each of its three state tournament games by double-digit margins, behind Cameron Curt and Macy Bogue. The Lynx won their final 25 games after dropping a one-point decision to CCA at Rivalry Saturday in November. Haley Miller joins Levine in a 3A team. Other first-team picks were Libby Fandel of Cedar Rapids Xavier and Carrington Asp of Western Dubuque in 4A, Chloe Meester of Mount Vernon, Emma Townsley of Benton Community, and Jaden Cooper of Monticello in 3A, Morgan Miller of Iowa City Regina in 2A, and Rowan Jacoby of Springville in 1A. Boys state basketball taking care of business. North Lynn whips Woodbine, heads to state semifinals for eighth year in a row by Jeff Johnson. All this time, everyone has ignored the Hilmer that really, truly deserves the credit for this incredible run North Lynn boys basketball has been on. Sure, Mike Hilmer is head coach, the director of perhaps Iowa's best small school program. His father, Bob, is the all-time winningest coach in the state history and was with his son as co-coach for some time. Mike's son, Jake, was a Mr. Basketball for the Lynx and helped them to championship. Younger son, Austin, was a star on another title team at North Lynn. Don't forget the contributions of J.C. Hilmer. As a coach's wife and player's mom, she's the unsung hero of this whole deal. Then there's little Jory Hilmer, Mike and J.C.'s youngest child, is 8 years old. North Lynn has been a state tournament qualifier all 8 years of her life. After 75-59 win Monday morning over Woodbine in a Class 1A state quarterfinal at Wells Fargo Arena, North Lynn has been a state tournament semifinalist all 8 years of her life. Just a coincidence, she's the lucky charm. And she will remind you of that, Mike Hilmer said with a laugh. Oh yeah, she's well aware of the streak. Of course, it has taken a whole lot of people for this school, located just outside Troy Mills, the smallest of small towns, for things to have gotten this way, this successful. The top-ranked, top-seeded Lynx, 24-1, gradually pulled away from a tight game in the third and fourth quarters, getting a little something from just about everyone. It was a little rough for the first half, said North Lynn's Jake Van Etten. The halftime talk was a little rough, but we knew we had to come out and play our game. They're a really good team, a really good 8 seed, probably one of the best we've played. We just had to do what we had to do. Woodbine, 23-3, with a lineup of all underclassmen, hung around trailing by 10 after the first quarter and 8 at halftime, scoring 8 of the first 9 points of the second half to pull within 34-33. But North Lynn reassessed itself, going back ahead by another 10 after 3 quarters, 56-46, and going further up in the fourth. The Lynx made one offensive adjustment that paid off. Instead of just going right at Winterset offensively, they brought their posts up toward the free throw line and top of the arc to try to create more inside room. It worked as guard Mason Beechin had 15 of his game-high 25 points in half number two, and Flugenhoff had 11 of his 15. Beechin had a team-high 9 rebounds and a team-high 5 assists. The first half, we were ramming it down their throats, Beechin said. The second half, we just kind of backed it up, waited for them to come out, their defense to come out against us. That created some wide-open lanes to drive. Wednesday is North Lynn's semifinal against number 5 Winfield Mount Union, 21-2. The Wolves won their Monday quarterfinal over 7th-ranked Linville Sully, 54-37. Tip-off is 5:30 p.m. Wednesday. I feel like this is just the standard meant to be met, said Van Etten, who had an 11.7-rebound game. If you're on the team, you want to be successful. Everyone's goal is to get down there and do the best you can. Freshman Landon Blum led Woodbine with 23 points, including going 7-for-11 from three-point range. He even banked in a pair of trays from out top on the wing when he was on third quarter heater. Northland shot 53.1% from the field, was 7 of 17 from distance, and 16 of 21 from the free throw line. Cale Benesch, Hayden Schmidt, and Drew Rees came off the bench to hit big threes at different times in the game. You get a little nervous when you're going to be the team that doesn't make it down here or something like that, Coach Hilmer said. We try not to put any pressure on them with anything like that, but I think they feel it sometimes. Class 2A Western Christian, too much for Regina. Regal's future looks bright despite lost by Jeff Johnson. The standards have been set, or reset, considering the history of Iowa City Regina's boys basketball program. No, the Regals didn't win their state tournament game last night. Western Christian is, well, Western Christian. The top-ranked and top-seeded Wolfpack are just too good for Regina in a 56-34 Class 2A quarterfinal win at Wells Fargo Arena. Western has been on the big stage in Des Moines 24 times and won it all 10 times. That's really good. Which is where Regina appears to be headed under first-year head coach Paul Rundquist. Winning 17 games this season, knocking off 5th-ranked Pella Christian in a sub-state final, and getting here was a heck of an accomplishment for the Regals, who'd won 22 games combined the previous 3 seasons. Regina wasn't overwhelmed in this game, sticking around most of the way. The Regals had a 6-4 lead late in the first quarter, but went on a scoreless drought the last 4 minutes and 18 seconds. Another 4-minute drought followed to open the second half. The initial drought allowed Western Christian, 21-3, to go on an 11-0 run in the first half for a lead it never relinquished. The second one allowed Western to take as much as an 18-point lead in the third quarter. It was 27-15 Wolfpack at the half. They did a fine job defensively, making everything offensively difficult for Regina. 6'3" junior guard Caden Van Riggenmorter, one of the 2 returning starters from last year's 2A state runner-up team, is a very hard guard to cover with his size and ability to handle and penetrate. He scored 13 first-half points for Western and finished the game with a high 19. The other returning starters, Karsten Morit, had 14 second-half points to finish with 18. Contrarily, Regina's leading scorer, Michael Martin, found the going rough. He finished with 13 points on 4 of 16 shooting. Boys basketball state tournament at Des Moines in the Wells Fargo Arena on Monday. Class 1A quarterfinals, number 1 North Lynn, 75, number 8 Woodbine, 59. Number 4 Winfield Mount Union, 54. Number 5 Linville Sully, 37. Number 2, Bellevue Marquette, 45. Number 7, Gladbrook Rhinebeck, 36. Number 3, Lake Mills, 58. Number 6, North Union, 50. Class 2A quarterfinals, number 1, Western Christian, 56. Number 8, Iowa City Regina, 34. Number 4, West Burlington, 22-0 versus Trainer, 21-3 was a late score. Today's games, Class 2A quarterfinals, number 2 Hudson, 23-2 versus number 7 Grundy Center, 20-3 at 10:30 a.m. Number 3 Underwood, 24-0 versus number 6 Unity Christian, 20-4 at 12:15 p.m. The Class 3A quarterfinals today, number 1 Decorah, 22-2 versus number 8 Williamsburg, 16-8 at 2 p.m. Number 4, Davenport Assumption, 16-8 versus number 5, Ballard, 16-8 at 3:45. Number 3, MOC Floyd Valley, 21-3 versus number 6, Bondurant Farrar, 15-9 at 5:30. Number 2, Waverly Shellrock, 20-3 versus number 7, Pella, 15-9 at 7:15 p.m. On Wednesday, Class 4A quarterfinals. Number 1, Cedar Rapids Kennedy, 23-0 versus number 8, Dallas Center Grimes, 20-3 at 10:30 a.m. Number 4, Dubuque Senior, 21-2 versus number 5, Ankeny, 17-6 at 12:15 p.m. Number 2, West Des Moines Valley, 18-5, versus number 7, Johnston, 14-9, at 2 p.m. And number 3, Cedar Falls, 20-3, versus Bettendorf, 17-6, at 3:45 p.m. The Class 1A semifinals on Wednesday. Number 1, North Lynn, 24-1, versus number 4, Winfield Mount Union, 21-2, at 5:30 p.m. Number 2, Bellevue Marquette, 26-1, versus number 3, Lake Mills, 25-1, at 7:15 p.m. At the Wells Fargo Arena, Woodbine, 59, Brandon Blum, 8-15, 0-0, 23. In girls basketball, the All-State Iowa Print Sports Writer Association Class 5A first team, Divine Bourage Jr., Davenport North, Mira Crawford Jr., Ankeny Central, Journey Houston, a junior, Davenport North, Grace Knutson, senior, Cedar Falls, Jenica Lewis, sophomore, Johnston, Emily Sorensen, junior, Waukee, Allie Tank, senior, Johnston, Ava Zediker, junior, West Des Moines Dialing. In the second team, Samantha Becker, sophomore, Cedar Rapids, Washington, Ferris Finley, sophomore, Cedar Falls, Kisten Hawk, senior, Waukee, Ellie Muller, sophomore, West Des Moines Dowling, Reagan Pagniano, junior, Pleasant Valley, Jaden Pratt, junior, Ankeny Centennial, Aaliyah Riley, senior, Johnston, Alex Flattery, senior, Sioux Center East. In Class 4A, the first team, Carrington Asp, junior, Western Dubuque, Bailey Birmingham, junior, Norwalk, Caitlin Agena, senior, Waverly Shellrock, Libby Fandel, junior, Cedar Rapids Xavier, Ava Locklear, senior, Clear Creek Amana, Avery Lauer, sophomore, Clear Creek Amana, Melina Snoozy, senior, Sioux City Helan, Brooklyn Stanley, senior, Sioux City Helan. On the second team, Macy Cornito, sophomore, Carlisle, Brooke Larson, junior, Lewis Central, Reggie Spots, senior, Mason City, Aaliyah Thompson, senior, Ballard, Abby Tuttle, junior, North Polk, Lauren Walker, junior, DeWitt Central, Cora Wydell, sophomore, Maquoketa, Yazim Witsit, senior, Decorah. In Class 3A, Peyton Harder, junior, Atlantic, Jaden Cooper, junior, Monticello, Kaylee Levin, senior, Solon, Miss Iowa Basketball 2024, Claire Lucan, junior, Dubuque Wallert, Chloe Meester, junior, Mount Vernon, Haley Miller, senior, Solon, Haley Stokes, junior, Esterville ELC, Emma Townsley, senior, Benton Community. On the second team, Bella Borges, junior, Mount West Marshall, Hayden Brown, sophomore, Forest City, Sydney Huber, junior, Mount Vernon, Brooke Krogman, Jr., West Delaware, Lauren McLaughlin, Jr., Algona, Aubrey Schwisho, Sr., Harlan, Ella Sherrar, Sr., Iowa Falls, Alden, and Claire Turner, sophomore, Spirit Lake. In Class 2A, first team, Lindsay Davis, Sr., Nottoway Valley, Desta Hugendorn, Sr., Central Lion, Brandy Krager, Sr., Sioux Central, Morgan Miller, Jr., Iowa City, Regina, Jaden Peterson, Sr., Dyke, New Hartford, Peyton Peterson, Sr., Dyke, New Hartford, Jaden Sellers, Sr., Panorama, Molly Schaefer, Jr., Eddyville, EBF. And on the second team, Marin Bixby, Sr., Dyke, New Hartford, Morgan Christian, Sr., Sioux Central, Ava Eastlick, Jr., Eddyville, EBF, Izzy Eisbach, sophomore, Nottoway Valley, Addie Johnson, senior, Westwood, Molly Rowling, junior, Cascade, Carly Willis, senior, Grundy Center, Avery Wilson, sophomore, Sioux Central. In Class 1A, Macy Bogue, senior, North Lynn, Abby Capesius, senior, Algona, Garrigan, Rowan Jacoby, sophomore, Springville, Whitney Jensen, senior, Remsen, St. Mary's, Kira Jungers, senior, Newell Fonda, Cameron Kurt, senior, North Lynn, Mallory Lear, Sr., West Hancock, McKenna Severs, Sr., Newell Fonda. Second team, Molly Bogue, Sr., North Lynn, Sarah Burton, Sr., Highland, Brinley German, Sr., Martinsdale, St. Mary's, Audrey Helmrich, Sr., or Jr., Edgewood Colesburg, Kaylee Hill, Sr., Calamus Wheatland, Kinsey Hinders, Jr., Newell Fonda, Eva Stephenson, Sr., Anita C.A.M., Era Underwood, sophomore, Council Bluffs, St. Albert. On the Insight page, a community letter, ranked choice voting complexity can be reduced. The Iowa legislature has put forth a bill to ban ranked choice voting. On February 18th, Gazette columnist Aletha Cole wrote that RCV is too complex. RCV can have reduced levels of complexity. Let's look at an example. Alaskans are happy with their version of RCV that has had an open primary with the top four vote winners being put on the general election RCV ballot. But if one is seeking to limit complexity, letting only the top three onto the general election ballot and into the debates would greatly simplify the process. In a three-way debate, there are only three one-on-one relationships between the three candidates. Three-way debates can be more positive than our usual two-way debates. Three-way debates create an incentive for candidates to not use negative ads and to be as forthright and respectful as they can be in their one-on-one debate exchanges. To win a majority in a three-way election, candidates will probably need second-choice votes. Voters also will have the new option to record their second choice. The voter will most likely give his or her second choice vote to the candidate who has the most respectful relationship with his or her first choice candidate. This creates the positive incentive. Three-way elections are both more positive and more complex. Different voters will have different preferences over this trade-off. Our democracy will be the most positive if we all affirm a goal of fairness in our voting system that is above partisan goals. Clark Reek, Cedar Rapids. We can reduce gender-based violence. The Battered Women's Movement, organized in the 1970s, and the Violence Against Women Act became law in 1994. Nearly 50 years later, we have not seen a decrease in violence against women. Maybe we need to change the narrative. Over 98% of violent crime is committed by men. Domestic and sexual violence committed by men costs employers and social systems billions of dollars each year. Most violent incidents against women are not even reported to law enforcement, so our current carceral interventions have little impact. If we really want violence against women to stop, we need to give men and boys the information and tools to be able to show up differently in their relationships. We can significantly reduce gender-based violence if we choose to. There are evidence-based curricula currently being used with men who harm women. Iowa needs to invest in them to give men an opportunity to learn healthy ways of being in a relationship. Gender-based violence is a learned behavior. Children who witness violence are far more likely to use or accept violence in relationships. Social scientists tell us that we cannot unlearn behaviors, but our brains are wired to learn new behaviors that can replace the old. Gender-based violence starts as soon as kids start dating, often by fifth or sixth grade. There are school-based curricula that can teach kids what healthy relationships look like and feel like before they establish harmful patterns that can set them up for a lifetime of violence. Those curricula need to be incorporated into Iowa schools. It is mind-boggling how we continue to stick our heads in the sand and pretend gender-based violence is not a problem because it's not happening to us. It's a societal problem, a community problem, and a family problem. It impacts our kids and grandkids when they sit next to a child in school whose mom got beat up the night before and can't get out of bed to make breakfast. The trauma of that incident will travel to school and the child will show up as maladaptive behaviors impacting the entire classroom. I'm calling on our leaders from school boards to the governor to take this public health crisis seriously and do these three things in 2024. Number one, fully fund programs that work with victims of gender-based violence. Number two, mandate anti-gender-based violence curricula to be taught in all schools beginning in fifth grade. And number three, fund evidence-based programs that teach men how to function in relationships without using coercive control and violence. We can better build families and communities. We can save millions in lost work, medical expenses, and court costs. More importantly, we can reduce generational trauma and suffering. My experience is that most men don't want to hurt the people they love. They simply don't have a healthy skill set to navigate interpersonal relationships. Lorraine Euling is Executive Director of the Family Crisis Center in Ottumwa. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Cadet for Tuesday, March 5th, 2024. I'm your reader, Denise. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.